Welcome to STEAM Powered, where I have conversations with women in STEAM to learn a little bit about what they do and who they are. I'm your host, Michelle Ong. My guest today is Dr. Eleanor Bell. Eleanor is a whale research scientist who is passionate about conservation and the polar marine environment and works to translate multinational research outcomes into policy. Join us as we talk about microbial ecology, seahorses, whales, and work in Antarctica. So welcome, and thank you so much for joining me today, Eleanor. I'm so happy to speak with you today all about your work in microbial ecology and, yeah, whales. So you started out in environmental biology and then moved to microbial ecology. But, you know, what attracted you to environmental biology to begin with?
I've always had a passion for the environment and animals and biology. I've always wanted to make a difference. So I remember being a very green university student, very staunch, you know, the sort of activist supporting all the NGOs. And so I was determined to do a conservation environment-based degree. And so I went to St Andrews University to do my undergraduate. And that was the environmental biology degree that they had on offer there. And the great thing about that degree was I could balance my passions for marine biology at the amazing Gatti Marine Laboratory there, or what was the Gatti Marine Laboratory, with passion for plants as well. I really loved plants. I loved everything. I just wanted to know everything. Wow. And soak everything up. So I ended up doing this quite broad degree, whereas others could specialize and go sort of, you could take two streams. You could be a marine and environmental biologist, or you could do plant environmental biology. And I just went for the environmental biology, so I could do a bit of everything. And that's really what it was. It was just going to a great university, beautiful place, doing some really amazing things, and having some very inspiring lecturers. There are particular lecturers that I remember who just bombarded us with in our lectures with amazing images of rainforest plants and coral reefs and told us about the ecology, and I was blown away.
Wow, that's amazing. It's wonderful that you're able to, you know, do such a broad range of topics in order to be able to just put together your passions. It's very cool.
Absolutely.
So the university worked with the marine lab, and that's how you were able to get the experiences over there?
The marine lab was part of the university at that time. It's now it's now a marine research laboratory up in Scotland. But at the time it was a marine biology lab, so a bit broader than focusing on marine mammals. And so we'd spent field work on shores, collecting shells, counting seaweed. We had other trips with other lecturers who took us into beautiful ancient woodlands in Scotland with bluebells on carpeting the woods and deciduous trees. And, you know, just heaven for me, really took you to your happy place whenever you were doing lectures or doing these field trips.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And I guess, I really thought coming out of that degree, I was headed for somewhere tropical, preferably Australia and the Dane Treaty, these rainforest trees, huge trees. And I had these visions of, you know, going through the rainforest, avoiding the massive spiders, because I wasn't all that much of a fan of spiders at that point anymore. Studying those.
Quite reasonable.
Off diving and snorkeling on coral reefs, stargazing at night, because I had quite a quite an interest in astrophysics.
Very fanciful.
So it was very fanciful, and I hoped I'd get there. And then my life took another course completely.
And is that where, you know, the microbial ecology came in?
Yeah, I remember distinctly at university, particular plant biology lesson, and it was looking at algae. We were looking at algae in drops of water under microscopes, and some of the algae are just stunning. I mean, there's a number of algae called, say, they're called diatoms. And they have silica frustules, or basically a little glass house around them. And they can be so ornamental and so pretty, a bit like snowflakes, some of them. And they blow your mind when you see them for the first time. And I can remember just being one of the few students who went, oh my goodness, they're so beautiful, and then ending up having a conversation with the lecturer, because she obviously, most people went, oh, microbiology is so boring and little things. I'm not saying I found it easy though, because I remember writing an essay about microbiology and my first essay, and not actually doing a particularly good job of it because it was such a new concept and I couldn't get my head around it, and I was trying to get this microbial loop of where algae and bacteria are cycling down at the bottom of the food web and recycling nutrients, and then it feeds up into the food web we're all more familiar with, and all the scientific concepts, and I just didn't quite get it. So my essay, you know, was not great and I didn't get an amazing score, but I'm tired enough to go, oh, I need to know more about this. But then set that aside. And then later on in our degree, I think it was our fourth year, we had an amazing gentleman and lecturer come up from the British Antarctic Survey to give us a polar ecology course. And we weren't looking at microbes, it was all the other cool polar animals and how they're adapted to life in Antarctica and the Arctic. And again, I was thinking, oh, this is absolutely fascinating, but there is no way I could go to work in Antarctica. I hate the cold. You know, I want these tropical rainforests. I want these. But would you believe it? I finished my degree, and the first thing I'm doing, I'm looking for a PhD. I'd done pretty well in my degree, and I was advised to go and do a PhD, and I'd really wanted to. I'd always known that was a career goal. And one of the first PhDs I saw advertised was for microbial ecologist to go down to Antarctica and study microbes in lakes in Antarctica.
Wow.
And part of me went, this is ridiculous. One, you don't like the cold. Two, it's microbes. Are you really inspired by those? They're hardy large rainforest trees. and then I went, you know, how many opportunities am I going to get in my life to potentially go to Antarctica? I'm going to go for it. And I did. And I, yeah, wonder of wonders, I actually got this PhD. And it was a time when in the UK you applied for a project that was already developed by a lecturer and they had something in mind they wanted to do and you came with it. So it's not like you can do here in Australia, or you can do now anywhere in the world, is design your own PhD project.
Yeah.
I'd gone into a pre-designed project that I could mold into my own. So within a few weeks of that application and getting the job, I was down in Australia, 3 weeks of training to get me ready to go to Antarctica. And a few weeks later, I was in Antarctica at 22, starting a PhD.
That's amazing.
A very long way from my supervisor, a very long way from my family.
Oh my goodness. How was that experience? Was it the first time you'd been that far away for that extended period?
Absolutely, because I spent 16 months in Antarctica uninterrupted. I didn't come home. You can't get out once you're in.
Yeah.
I was one of the there were only a couple of us, two women on station, and I think we were 18 men with us, and we two women were very young. We were both PhD students under the same supervisor, and so it was a whole new experience for us both in terms of scientific learning, a very rapid learning curve, because I'd never done any of this stuff before, and I was learning on my feet and on the job. And also socially, just living in an isolated environment with people who were from all different walks of life, very different backgrounds. Australian for one, you know, I was the two women on station, we were both young female scientists from the UK, very different background to all the Australian men effectively who were on station. And so it was a very interesting.
Wow. So what sort of preparation do they have you do before you actually head down to Antarctica?
Okay, well, yes, we do a lot. I obviously did some scientific training. My supervisor brought me over to La Trobe University for a few weeks and we did some intensive training in the lab because I knew I was going to be taking lots of water samples. I was going to prepare them for the microscope. I was going to have to measure various chemicals in the water and I had to learn all these techniques and at least run through them a couple of times with her and, you know, design the protocols of what I was going to do. And so I had that intense training. Wow. And then came down to Hobart, the Australian Antarctic Division. And at that point, you're getting the very intense field training, how to do rope work in go down a crevasse, or a vehicle tips over, how you write a big vehicle. how to walk safely on ice. Don't go through it, because I was going to be working on frozen sea ice and frozen lake ice, which you have to be able to test it safely so you don't end up into very cold water.
Yes.
We were going to be flying around in helicopters, so there's helicopter safety work. There was a degree of medical training, because at any point in time you might be called upon on station to help assist with surgeries and things like that if there was a medical emergency. So we did that. Very intense aid training. Some people got fire training. I wasn't there long enough to do the whole cohort of training, but you know, a lot of people on station trained as fire officers, because that's our biggest risk when we're down in Antarctica, if the station goes up in flames.
Yes.
So it was a whole absolute huge range, spending time, just campcraft. How do you deal with the intense cold and campfire wind and, you know, safely do that sort of thing? So yeah, massive amounts of training and preparation.
That seems very intimidating for someone who would have been just fresh out of university and, you know, just, yeah, having such an incredibly, extremely different life experience.
Yeah, it was actually a lot of fun. I'd done a lot of sort of camping and that sort of work with Duke of Edinburgh School. And I know it's very far removed in Antarctica, but I had an outdoor passion, and I was quite happy to learn new skills, and I've always thrived on learning new stuff. So I very much enjoyed it. And I suppose the key to all that training is not just safety, but it's the bonding with the group you're going to spend the next, you know, basically year and a half with, and you can't get away from. So it's learning about other people, learning communication styles. And there are all this psychological preparation that goes on as well, and briefings. And of course, the very important training about sort of how to interact with one another, interpersonal connections and communication, harassment training. What do you do if there's any harassment issues or bullying issues? Really, they're really key, actually. I would say those social skills are more important than the actual physical skills.
Yeah, because yeah, those are the only people you can interact with for the entire period. You have no choice but to figure out how to get along and to, you know, be able to communicate well with them.
No, yeah. Now, the social side can either make or break your project, can make or break you, you know, so it's really important.
Yeah, it's brilliant that they actually put so much thought into the social aspect of the training as well. It makes sense, of course, but, you know, I had no idea that there was that much detail as part of the preparation. It's very good.
Yeah, it's even more intense now. They're learning more and more, and every year these training programs evolve and they're getting better and better.
That's wonderful. So how did you find your first experience in Antarctica and in the cold, and pretty much where you have to be very self-sufficient, because like you said, like, you know, access to assistance and, you know, backup of any sort is very limited.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm brutally honest, you say it's one of the best experiences of my life, but also one of the worst, because it is intense. It's incredibly hard to be away from your family. There's always going to be interpersonal issues that just become little niggles, become big issues and dramas and stresses. And you miss home and you're very isolated. But in terms of what we did and what we experienced, it was phenomenal. I'm never happier than when I'm on the ice. I love woodlands. I love green spaces. That's another passion of mine. But when I'm working, I love being out on the ice. I love the environment. I love being the cold, which is ironic for that student who thought, I don't like being cold, but the gear you get is so good. And if you're dressing well and you're layering up, you don't feel the cold. It's so dry down in Antarctica. To be honest, the closest I've come to being dangerously cold and mild hypothermia was working in Scotland, where it's wet and damp and cold. In Antarctica, if you're wearing the right gear, the cold doesn't seep through to your bones the same that it does in other damper places. I mean, for goodness sake, I feel colder sometimes in Tasmania than I ever did in Antarctica, because houses aren't well insulated, and you know, we get lazy about clothes. We step outside thinking, oh, it's not too bad, and then you end up damp and cold.
You don't have that luxury in Antarctica.
You don't come out unless you're fully prepared with a full emergency kit. You know what you're doing, you're fully trained. And the most I ever experienced and anyone I knew experienced was you get little, sometimes get a little bit of frost nip where you get a tiny white patch where maybe your balaclava has got a bit of ice and it's frozen to your skin, and you just get a little white patch. You just have to warm up, you know, put the heel of your palm on, warm it up, or really cold fingers, which is can be agonizing to warm up, but never as severe as frostbite or anything like that. And that's often part of the parcel of working with a lot of water in a very cold environment.
Yes, can imagine that. Yeah, so after that, you mentioned you did work on seahorses. So how did that come about?
Yeah, so in Antarctica, I was working on beautiful lakes. There's a whole load of lakes where we are that are basically relics of when the glaciers retreated, the ice age, and the land, well, isostatic uplift it's called, where the land raises up, the glacial weights off that land, and there are scoured pockets where the ice has created craters in the earth, basically. And those were filled with water, and they're the lakes that I was then working on. And they've been isolated from the environment for 8,000, 10,000 years. So they have really unique microbial communities. So I was doing that. Wow. But like, and it was really exciting going out every week, following these lakes, taking samples, and literally getting an idea of how the system was changing throughout the year, the annual cycle of light and dark and ice cover and no ice cover. Flying around in helicopters, driving fast on quads around the ice and Haglands and having a fantastic time. But like all PhDs, you have to come home at some point and write up. And by the time I came back to Australia, and I was here for a few months finishing up at the Australian Antarctic Division with all my samples, because obviously I had thousands of litres of samples and heavy that I hadn't necessarily finished with all of them.
Yes.
I could use in the labs here. They weren't going to be shipped anywhere. It's just too expensive. So I did that. And then I went back to Nottingham University, where my supervisor was then based. And I wrote up there and had a lovely time. I had some really good supportive friends. But it's not a fun time running your PhD. I don't actually know any PhD students who've gone through and not thought about dropping out within a few months of finishing, because they're just so stressed and so fed up. And I came close as well to going, I just can't do this, you know. What am I doing? This is going to be rubbish. And so by the time I finished, you know, I did finish. I actually thoroughly enjoyed the Viva way. Where you have the interview, the one-on-one interview, when you finish your thesis and it's being examined, and then you have the oral with two external examiners. And I can remember being one of these ridiculous people who went in really nervous, but 4 hours later came out of the interview going, that was just brilliant. I had so much fun talking about it all. And my supervisor's nervously sitting there going, that was only supposed to be an hour and a half long. What's wrong? And I said, nothing went wrong. We had an absolute brilliant time. We had a ball. So I got my PhD.
Ooh, I was going to say, 4 hours is a very long thesis defense. My goodness.
I didn't expect it. And it didn't feel like that. And it didn't have to go on that long. We just had fun. I never felt threatened.
That's amazing.
And I never felt like I was being scrutinized. It was just a really good talk about the experience and the work and where it could go. And it was just really, really good. And I actually, one of the examiners I ended up working with in Antarctica.
Very cool.
Later on, several years later. But, you know, having made that connection, it was great. To cut a long story short, I was completely jaded with microbial stuff by then. Not that I didn't like the microbes, I just needed a break from that intensive work I'd been doing. I didn't really want to go straight into a similar postdoc. So I was just searching around for something I could do that would still use the transferable skills that I'd gained and that independence of having worked in Antarctica and all the interpersonal skills. I'm looking for something that would take me a little bit closer to my passion for real conservation. That doing pure science is great, but I wanted to apply it somehow. I needed to know it was going to make a difference. And that's where the seahorses came in. It was, once again, I'm looking around for postdocs, pretty aimless. I knew what I didn't want to do at that point in time, but I didn't know what I did want to do. And another postdoc just came up that was to work with Project Seahorse, which is a seahorse conservation organization that was then based out of McGill University in Montreal, Canada. And they were looking for basically anyone who with a biological background who had a passion for conservation and was interested. And again, I thought, I've got no hope. You know, I've been working in Antarctica, not tropical coral reefs. I've been working with microbes, not anything even vaguely fishy, never mind seahorsey. And there's no way they're going to want me. But I applied anyway. And I was actually flown to Canada for an interview, which is an extraordinary experience. I think we actually went to Chicago to the Shedd Aquarium for the interview rather than Canada. And there were various candidates. And one of them happened to be one of the girls that I'd done. The other girl student that I'd been in Antarctica with. So we felt very awkward about this.
Funny,
we
had small world.
Discussion about it. We were both applying for the same. Well, how did we feel? And in the end, we decided, I think, you know, it was actually, looking back, it was pretty amazing that we did. We just said, you know what, let's just go and have fun. They want to fly us to the States to interview us. Let's just go and have fun. And we got on the plane. We actually got upgraded. So we had a lovely flight over together. We obviously got on well because we've been in the past together. And we just enjoyed the experience and neither of us expected to get anywhere. I suppose the only awkwardness would have come when I got the job and she, I reckon she probably would have done a better job than me actually. But I was offered the job and it was an extraordinary experience. Again, I thought very strongly, do I really want to do this? It's away from home again, going to Canada this time. But just had to take an opportunity when it came up to do something extraordinary.
That's wonderful. Yeah, that's very cool. And yeah, it's daunting to go so far away from the environments that you're familiar with. And, you know, I guess having done the Antarctic trip, it made it a bit more, it wouldn't be familiar, but at least you know what to sort of expect out of that kind of distance and experience. So yeah, it's great that you took that opportunity.
Absolutely. And I knew that Canada had enough cold weather that it would match my Antarctic experience, but also warm weather. And I knew I could get on a plane and come home, or my parents could come to me anytime. So it was nowhere near as isolating.
Yeah.
And I was learning, you know, I was in Montreal, French speaking. So was hoping to use some of my French and I was still applying skills I'd learnt. But what was extraordinary about the project was that it was, you know, the seahorses themselves are extraordinary creatures that, you know, everyone, they're most known, well known for them being the male that gets pregnant, the male that carries the eggs and then gives birth to the young. So that's extraordinary in itself. But it was the fact that they were an amazing icon or mascot for conservation. So you have this really charismatic fish that you can use to sell so many of the conservation ideas. And that's what appealed to me, because you're not just talking about conserving seahorses themselves. You end up talking about habitat destruction because it's their habitats that are being destroyed. You end up talking about livelihoods, alternative livelihoods for the communities that rely on fishing seahorses, finding an alternative for them. So I did a lot of work with the communities in the Philippines, helping them develop products such as woven baskets with seahorses on that would be sold to the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago and other aquaria within around the States, to provide an alternative that they didn't fish as many seahorses, so they stayed in the environment, and helping them set up marine protected areas so the seahorses had somewhere safe where the fishers wouldn't go and take them. And then ended up in sort of the entrepot in Hong Kong, where they trade an awful lot of species for various medicinal purposes. And that's one of the big places that seahorses end up, dried seahorses. But that was one of the things that struck me as being so important. We weren't just hammering a conservation message, don't fish seahorses, they're
taking away.
They're endangered. we're trying to give something back, helping them establish a guest house where they can have tourists come, eco-tourists come. So there was some income coming in, and you take these tourists out to snorkel and see the seahorses rather than fishing them. Establishing small marine protected areas and a network along the coast. So it was all incremental steps to help the community help themselves effectively.
That's amazing.
And also doing education programs with the kids. I can remember writing sort of programs. And that's where a bit of one of my passions lies, is education and outreach. And so there were so many elements to that job. And one of the lovely things was that I was based in Montreal at McGill University, but for a week every month I spent in Chicago, and I worked at the Shedd Aquarium. And there I helped the big, beautiful Seahorse Symphony exhibit, which was all about how beautiful seahorses and their relatives like pipefish and sea dragons. And there were a lot of conservation messages in that. So I was helping to design the exhibit and add the conservation messages and produce educational materials. So there were so many elements of the job that were fascinating.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So I know that seahorses are used in traditional Chinese medicine, but what other industries or what other purposes were they being fished for?
They were being fished for live for aquarium, the aquarium trade. Several million a year end up in the aquarium trade. And the unfortunate thing about that is they often die en route, or when they get to aquaria, they're very delicate creatures. They have, you know, a very bony skeleton, and which is why they dry so beautifully. But they have a very thin skin, which is prone to infections. And they also have a very specialist diet. They're called the family, you know, so the scientific name is Cygnethidae. So the fused jaw. So all the seahorses and their relatives, pipefish, sea dragons, pipe dragons, have this fused straw-like jaw, and they suck food up. And they basically ambush prey as it's swimming by. The seahorses hear the prey swims by and it's ambushed, sucked up. And so it's actually hard to keep them in aquaria, because you can't just put a few flakes on the top of the tank. You need to have live prey in there, and that live prey has to have a sufficient quality and vitamin content that the seahorses are healthy. So they don't do very well in the live trade. So that was another education message. Just don't keep them. If you're going to have aquarium fish, don't have seahorses, because most of them don't survive, no matter your good intentions. And then because they dry really well, a lot is sold for souvenirs. So those seahorse key rings or seahorses in resin. So again, it's just the messaging was not just about seahorses, about all of these creatures. Just don't buy animals that are stuffed in resin and in a paperweight key ring. It's not necessary.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, it makes perfect sense. So after seahorses, you found your way back to microbial ecology, or was that where you kind of went to even bigger, to whales?
No, that's when I went back to microbial ecology. So I left Canada and came back to the UK for a while. I was ready to finish and move on. And I did go back to sort of my roots and microbial work. And again, that was just chance. I actually didn't know what I wanted to do. I had a period at home, a few months, where I didn't have a job. And I put myself through an intensive driving course, because I'd really hated learning to drive when I was younger, and just refused. It basically gave up. Too stressful. Didn't need a car. I was happy to walk and cycle everywhere. And it was later in life it became apparent that having a driving license is very useful for getting jobs and doing field work. So I did an intensive driving course. And then once again, I'm looking around for postdocs, alternative postdocs, and something came up in Germany, and it was microbial work. And what was intriguing about it was it did focus on something I knew about, so I felt a bit more confident applying for it. It was focused on, firstly, extremophiles, which basically that's extreme loving organisms. So microbes that like living in tough environments. So I'd done the Antarctic. This time it was to work on microbes that lived in extremely acidic lakes in Germany. So there's a region in Germany called the Lausitz, which had a lot of brown coal mining. And the old mining pits have now filled with water leached, and they are so acidic. You know, we're talking pH 2 to 3, extremely acidic.
Oh, goodness.
So you'd think grow in them, and they're in this extraordinary color. Some of them are bright red, literally like the bright red behind me in the sunlight. They're incredibly red.
Wow.
All the leachate that's coming in through the soils. And but organisms do live there, bacteria, viruses, incredible algae that have just adapted to living there, and even some small single-celled animals. Heliozoa are one of them. They're literally called Heliozoa because they're sun animals. They look like little suns. And they were what I ended up working on and doing various experiments. And it linked with what I'd been doing in Antarctica really well. And it's another one of those moments in my life where I almost didn't do it because I thought, oh, really? Do I want to live in Germany? Coming from the UK, you have these stereotypical views of, you know, Germany must be all bombed out after the war. And it's, you know, it just, I suppose that's when you brought up these unconscious biases you have about the nation that you were, the nation that your nation was at war with. And they were completely unfounded, you know, that was never said to me. But I worried I'd end up in an industrial, very modern city that had been rebuilt past the, you know, post-war. And I might not be very happy. And gosh, I didn't know a single word of German. How was I going to manage? But I went for the interview thinking, well, at least it's practice. You know, if nothing else, if someone's offering to fly you to another country, you go, you have the experience. And even if you don't get the job, you learn from it. And oh my goodness, I fell in love with it. I was based at Potsdam University. And it's one of my favorite places in the world. I loved chocolate box perfect buildings, color, lakes,
wow,
rivers, woods, just everything I wanted, plus some amazing people. So I had some of the happiest 5 to 6 years of my life there. And I wouldn't have left if I didn't sort of have a career offer, you know, a career progression offer.
Yeah.
That my head told me to take, even though my heart was saying that Germany's your place to be. So I had an absolute ball there, and I had so much support and freedom that I was able to write lots of grants for European grants for money that were very good at that point in time. And actually took myself back to Antarctica to do another postdoc looking at microbes in Antarctica. And I also got to go to the Arctic as well through that, through being there, just by writing grants, getting the money, being supported by my supervisor to do whatever I wanted and take my research where I wanted. So had an awful lot of fun.
It's wonderful that you were given such a wonderful opportunity to be so flexible about the kind of work that you could do. Is that common in postdocs, or is that just based on, you know, who you're working with and where you're based?
Well, in my experience, it's not always common. When I was a postdoc with the seahorses, there was flexibility in the sense of I had very diverse tasks, but I had a very specific role. I think it was just the nature of the group I was with. I had a very supportive boss. So I was doing microbial stuff. It all fit within the remit of extreme algae, extreme bacteria. How are they surviving? So the pieces of the puzzle all came together. And it's bringing money into a university, it's bringing kudos. And so they didn't mind at all. The German system was very well set up for that, for you to follow your own threads and paths. And as long as you got the job done that you'd originally been employed for. Originally, I think they'd only had, I struggle to remember, but 18 months to 2 years money for me for that particular postdoc. And I did that. It was at the end, I just kept finding money to stay with the group and just evolve my research and take them along with me a little bit as well. And I could have continued doing that for the rest of my life, but the system in Germany is such that if I'd wanted to go the next step to being a lecturer, I would have had to probably move to another institution. You generally do 6 years in an institution, and then if you're going to get the next step, you go somewhere else. And I didn't want to go anywhere else. I wanted to stay where I loved in Potsdam. And but I was headhunted for a lectureship position in Scotland. So I went to Scotland.
So from Scotland, what did you end up doing after your lectureship?
So after lecturing for, I think I was in Scotland for about 5 years, and I loved it. I absolutely loved lecturing. I did obviously did research as well, went to the Arctic, did a lot of microbial research, and but I was teaching a lot of marine conservation. That was one of the elements that got me the job. They said, what would you like to teach? And I said, well, I've noticed you haven't got a marine conservation course. I'll put one together for you and I'll teach that. And I had such a ball because I could bring in my elements of all my knowledge, seahorse ecology and coral reef ecology and microbial and you name it. And I had a lot of fun designing interactive exercises for the students. And it was a very small new university. But that reignited my passion for, okay, I do love microbial stuff and I love going to the Antarctic and the Arctic, but I still need that applied focus in my life. I need to know that I'm making a difference, not just to the students that I'm teaching, but to the world. And it just so happened that by that point in time, I, you know, met my husband and we'd got together and that's a story in itself, meeting sort of in Antarctica, but he'd come to live with me in Scotland and it got to the point where he created a master's in order to be with me in Scotland, and we lived there and worked, but he couldn't find anything. He finished his master's. It's very, where the marine lab was that I was working, it was a very small place in Oban on the west coast of Scotland, and there weren't any opportunities really for him to develop his own career. And so we made the collective decision to come back to Australia to where his family was. We had a family at the time. We had a 2-year-old little boy, and I was very heavily pregnant with my daughter, who arrived literally 3 or 4 weeks after I arrived in Australia. And so I had a period in my life where I was working. Well, I was working on a different sort of work, as you know. And I was actually finishing editing and writing a book on extremophiles, life in extreme environments, that I'd started, so it gave me some focus. I have to be when this baby comes, So I literally submitted.
Yes.
Yeah, I literally submitted the book to the publishers as I was in labour, and then went to the press, send on the email, and turned around. And
said, right, my goodness!
So it was that tight.
Wow, that's diligent.
It was a bit nuts looking back. It was what I had to do, otherwise that book would never have been finished. But anyway,
goodness.
I had then 11 it gets worse. I had 11 months of not working. But I suppose it was maternity leave, so that's definitely work with two little kids.
It's fair enough.
In a new country with new house and, no family around to support me. So that was an interesting time. But again, I started searching around for knowing at about a year old I'd be willing to have an old friend who was the wife of someone I'd wintered with my first winter in Antarctica. And turned out she was running a childcare business. And so we ended up with an amazing place for our children. And so I could start thinking about going back to work. And it was, again, what on earth am I going to do? I know I want to work at the Australian Antarctic Division if I can, because that's where I've got experience. And Hobart is the gateway to Antarctica. And so I applied for a job that came up, and it just happened to be whales, within the whales group here at the Australian Antarctic Division. And what appealed to me was not that it was whales, because although I love them, I was never the marine biologist who was set on, I'm going to work on whales and dolphins.
Yeah.
I was drawn by the conservation aspect. I was very much working with the International Whaling Commission, looking at ways to do research that will contribute to the conservation and management of whales and other cetaceans and marine mammals. And so I applied for the job. And it was to be a coordinator of a big Antarctic blue whale project that was under development. And I didn't actually get that job. I wrote the application with a very young baby on my chest, 4 a.m., absolutely exhausted. absolutely wrecked because she, my daughter, did not ever sleep.
Oh no.
And you know, I don't know how I even got to the interview. But it was one of those interviews where I went into going, I'm so tired. I don't think I'm the right person for this job. I'm just going to go and make the most out of it and enjoy it. And I actually really did enjoy the interview, and I could draw on all my aspects of the conservation I've done with seahorses to bring it into this, plus the scientific background and the fact I'd done 2 winters in Antarctica by that point. So they were saying, well, would you be willing to go south? Yeah, absolutely. No problem going to Antarctica here. And I've done lots of marine voyage work. So
yeah,
that was all fine. And I didn't actually get that specific job I applied for because they had a sort of slightly more qualified candidate who'd done very specific work that fit.
Yes.
But about a month later, and it wasn't a surprise to me, I wasn't worried. I didn't mind staying at home a little bit longer with the kids. About a month later, I get a phone call from the person who interviewed me saying, look, you did so well at interview. We've had another job come up. Someone's decided to leave suddenly, and we actually need you for this sort of bigger, broader role. Would you be interested? So that's where I am now. I said, yeah, sure.
Wonderful.
There I am, working with whales, and
that's brilliant. So I guess the big question for me is, how do you manage juggling young children and having to take your, you know, I guess your field journeys to Antarctica?
Well, it's a good question. There was a good period where I didn't go to Antarctica because the kids were too young, and it would not have been fair on my partner to leave him with the children. I distinctly remember the first time I had to leave my little girl would have been just over 1 or just under 1. So I just had the job for a month, and I was sent to Panama as part of the Australian delegation representing Australia's interests in the International Whaling Commission at their scientific committee, where you talk about the research that is applied to the conservation and management decisions that higher level politicians make at the commission meetings later. My daughter was only about 11 months old, and it was the first time I'd left her, and I was only going for, I think, 10 days, but I was breastfeeding at the time. And it's the classic story I know you've heard before, that, you know, I'm pumping, and sadly I tried to find a milk bank in Panama before I went, thinking at least if I'm pumping, I can donate it to a hospital or somewhere. But of course it's really hard. The amount of testing you have to do to actually do that and check that your milk is safe. Yes. In the end, I just ended up the heartbreaking, you know, pumping milk and pouring it down the sink. And that's my overriding memory of that meeting, is like watching breast milk go down the sink.
Oh no.
I'm thinking, oh my goodness, you know, what's gonna happen when I get back? But it's an amazing experience meeting new people, and really that front line, this is where science matters, where you're presenting science and you know that it's being used for the greater good.
Absolutely.
Came back, and I kept going annually to those meetings. But I suppose the children were, I think they would have been, I'm racking my brain now to think, but they would have been more closer to 6, 7 before I actually went to Antarctica again. And I was very selective about only doing trips that were a few weeks, 3 or 4 weeks long. We had some very interesting opportunities to go on tourist vessels around the West Antarctic Peninsula, which is the bit of Antarctica that sticks up under South America. Yes. So you can fly to South America and then get on a tourist vessel, go down very quickly, a few days you're in Antarctica. And we're very privileged to be able to use the boats on and the coxswains they had on those boats off the tourist vessels and drive around, do our whale work, tagging them, putting cameras on them, taking biopsy samples, while the tourists then got the experience of watching what we did, and we gave lectures when we got back on board, and it was all that ecotourism aspect. And I absolutely
It
combined the passion for outreach with being in the field in Antarctica, having a great time. And it was perfect because then I was away for 3 or 4 weeks, which is manageable for my husband and for, you know, my mum fly over from England sometimes to help. And it was all round. And then it was only later, I suppose the longest trip I've done to Antarctica recently was going down on a voyage, a marine science voyage in 2019 to study blue whales and krill, and we were down at sea for 7 weeks, which seemed like a long time away from the family, but this was pre-COVID and my mom was able to come over from the UK and help look after the kids. So that set my mind at rest. And
yes,
and comms so good in Antarctica now. We were WhatsApping and phoning people, Facebooking. You really can do pretty much anything. You can phone all the time and it doesn't cost you thousands of dollars. Like my first winter in Antarctica, my phone bill was thousands of dollars. Now it's free if you use WhatsApp. So it's a very different kettle of fish that you're not as isolated anymore, which is a good thing and a bad thing.
Yes.
But I could keep in touch with the children. And which was particularly important because that was the year we had the terrible fires down in Tasmania, and that was quite terrifying for us all to be on a ship away from our families.
Yeah.
We knew our properties were under threat, and not a fun time to be away.
No, that's good that you're still able to stay in touch and just make sure everything's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So is the research that you were doing as part of the ecotourism? Was that part of the food chain that you're working on at the moment?
It's all connected. One of the key roles I play in my job, as part of being under the in that International Whaling Commission family, where it's scientists working together, there's one consortium that was actually founded by Australia, but is multinational, that has a lot of nations working together to collaborate on research that's non-lethal research that can advance the best practice of working on whales and other marine mammals with minimum invasive techniques and minimum harm to those animals, but to deliver the biggest bang for your buck in terms of science.
Yeah.
So our team does everything from putting incredible devices called sonar buoys into the ocean to listen for whales. These are ex-military devices that the military uses now. They throw them out of planes and helicopters to listen for enemy submarines and I was going to say vehicle. We can't say vehicle underwater, but that sort of thing underwater. Whereas we've been able to change that technology and use it for scientific purposes. So these amazing devices can pick up blue whale song, and blue whales have one of the sort of loudest, lowest sounds on the planet, and that sound transmits through water hundreds of thousands of kilometers. And so as we're departing on our ships out of Hobart and sailing past the tip of Tasmania and on our ways, quite often we go past New Zealand, you start hearing the Antarctic blue whales and other whales down in Antarctica.
Wow.
And rather than traditionally ships went and you needed a lot of time and a lot of money just to go up and down in sort of a transect pattern, just searching for whales. And if you got lucky, you'd come across some and you could stop and study them. Now we can go pretty much straight to where the whales are because we can hear them singing.
That's brilliant.
And vocalizing. And then when we get there, we can deploy other amazing technologies that have been developed by both our team and this team in this collaborative consortium that I work within and I help to manage. So we can deploy very sophisticated satellite tags on the whales that allow us to track where they're moving. So you know a little bit more about their migration routes and which are the important areas that they use that you might need to protect in some way. You can... if you can get close enough you have to get very close to do that. But you know, you can even just getting close enough to take amazing photos of whales. You can get a library of photographs of whales, and they've got different species have got different identifying marks that are unique to individuals. And you can compare catalogues over years, for example, humpback whale flukes, most people will be most familiar with, or the Antarctic blue whales, their flank, the top of their back. With the dorsal fin, there's amazing sort of bluey grey mottling pattern, which is very unique to that whale.
Wow.
You can just build up a picture through the years. Are we seeing this whale over and over in certain areas? And that gives you an indication, is the population very small? So we only see the same whales over and over. Is it very, is it quite big? Because you don't see them very often. And you can look at how they're moving around. And it all pieces together the information you need to manage a population. How big is it? What are the critical areas it needs it? And then again, if you can get close enough on small boats, usually, so you go on a big mother vessel and you launch small boats, you can take biopsy samples, which are just skin and blubber samples from a whale.
Yeah.
And those can be analysed to look at the genetics of the animal. Is it male or female? If it's a female animal, is she pregnant? Which is a good sign, because obviously the population's healthy, it's doing well, it's reproducing. You can, that identification signature, again, if you've got the biopsy the next year of the same animal, you can see where it's been. You can look at the diet, what they're eating, what are their critical foods, their health. There's all sorts of things you can do with a biopsy sample. So those are the sort of the icing on the cake if you can get close enough to tag an animal and get biopsies. But every little bit of information we get is really critical.
That's amazing. So what are you working on specifically at the moment?
At the moment, the team's not going in the field, obviously, because of COVID. So we're all feeling a bit antsy and grounded.
Yes.
We want to be on boats chasing whales. But we're writing data. There have been some major voyages recently, in particular. So I mentioned that voyage that I went on in 2019. And we were looking for blue whales. They were our target species. Antarctic blue whales are critically endangered. There are only, you know, maybe 3,000 to 6,000 left. Nobody really knows yet. So we're trying to get all the information we can about them to get a new population estimate, to see if they're actually recovering after literally being almost brought to extinction by industrial whaling. And so we were targeting the blue whales. We were finding them using the sonar buoys I told you about. We were on a ship that we couldn't launch small boats from. So it was very much our work was from the vessel itself, getting close to the whales, as close as it was safe and as long as we didn't disturb them. And we were getting really good photographs of them and drone footage of them. But it was unique, and it was a really multidisciplinary study. So we didn't go just to look for the whales. We had amazing krill biologists on board who were mapping the 3D maps of the krill that were where the whales were. And not just, it was blue whales, fin whales, and humpback whales primarily that we came across. And looking at what sort of krill the whales associated with. So most people listening would know that krill swarm, like bees, enormous, you know, swarms of krill, millions if not billions of creatures, big. And they can, some of these can extend for over a kilometer wide. They're this massive. You can almost see them, you know, see them from the drone imagery, and the water looks red. And they come up on the active acoustics data instruments as big bands of red and yellow across the screen on the ship. And you can, as you go along the ship, you can actually map it. And then you can see if the whales are associating with them. And so one of the thoughts is that blue whales seem to be associated more with very dense, shallow swarms of krill, whereas there are other whales that don't mind a more diffuse, spread out swarm that's deeper. And when you start looking at it, it makes sense, because a blue whale is over 30 meters long. They're huge. You know, I think they weigh as much like 70 African elephants. When they open their mouths and engulf multiple Olympic swimming pools worth of water and krill, they come to a standstill. It's very energetically expensive for them to do that and then squeeze all the water out and sieve the krill out using their baleen plates. And so they only do it when it's makes sense for them to do it. They're not going to waste time snapping at little pockets of krill. They're going to go for a big load of krill. Whereas some of the other whales we've worked out, like little minke whales, they're not little, they're still 9-10 meters long, but they're much more maneuverable. I suppose little sleek missiles that go in and out of the ice, and they're much more likely to take small dives for lots of little patches of krill. So it all ties into the energetics,
yeah,
which then ties into the where the conservation management comes in, is it ties into, okay, humans are wanting to target krill as well as a resource. It's a very well managed resource, and the fishery doesn't take anywhere near as much as it could biologically at this point in time. But is it still competing with creatures like whales? Because of course a fishing boat is going to target these dense swarms that are easy to maximize your catch with very little effort, yeah, like the blue whales do. So that's where that plays in.
Exactly.
So to come back to answering your question, what we're doing now is looking at data that's come from that. And then another voyage that literally happened at the beginning of this year, which was also targeting krill with colleagues, the same colleagues, basically synthesizing the data, putting it together and feeding that up to bodies such as the International Whaling Commission and an organization called CAMLAR, which is the Convention for the Conservation of Antarctic Marine Living Resources, where a lot of people here work with as well. And how that scientific information feed into the decisions that are made that manage the krill fishery, that manage whale conservation, and where you might put marine protected areas, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, like you said, it all ties together because they're part of the, you know, same community ecosystem and, you know, food cycle. That's very, very cool. So I saw that part of the work that you do is seeing, because of that very small food chain, that, you know, the whales will eat the krill, poop the basically fertilize the ocean, help create more krill, and, you know, it just cycles again. And there was a bit where it was saying that, you know, you did observe the whales' toileting behaviors, but how do you observe whale toileting behaviors?
Well, if you happen to be on deck when there are whales in the dry, you can't really miss it because these plumes of poo are tens of meters long and they're bright orange because of the eating. So you really can't miss it. What's tricky is collecting it. And obviously on a big vessel like we were on, you can't stop the ship and collect poo, but in other colleagues around the world, and we have on occasion have had success at collecting this poo when you're on a small boat and you're very maneuverable, you can stop and grab a few samples. But what we were able to do was target areas using the sonobuoys where we knew there were lots of whales, go to them. And if we observed feeding behavior, so you know, the assumption is if something's feeding, it's going to be pooing very fairly shortly afterwards. This is obviously quite a productive area. There's lots of krill, there must have been lots of phytoplankton on the krill we're eating, etc., etc. So at you have this chain of suppositions you make about this area. So we went to a feeding aggregation of whales. We took water samples at what we called time zero when we got there. And then we followed that body of water. We put what's called a drogue. So it's basically a drifting buoy with electronic devices in it that follows that body of water and goes where the current takes it. And then we in the ship followed that water as well and took samples every day over a 5-day period and analyze those samples to see if the fact that although we hadn't observed pooing in the water, whether that body of water where whales had been feeding and obviously would have been pooing had fertilized their patch of ocean. Now that's not a simple experiment to do in the massive Southern Ocean, and it's
no, it's not
inclusive. What we can say to date is that yes, we observed microbial activity, so bacterial activity increase as a result of there having been whales and krill there. The next step was then that there were students on the voyage who took water from the environment and spiked them with poo that had been collected previously and added in laboratory circumstances to see the effect on growth. And then you do see a very clear and marked effect of adding poo, which is very rich in iron, which is something that the phytoplankton need, that spikes bacterial growth and spikes phytoplankton growth. And so it's a hypothesis that's pretty well known and well tested to date, that you add iron into the Southern Ocean, which is it's very poor in iron, and so much so that you add one paperclip worth of iron in an Olympic-sized swimming pool, there's so little there, but yet it's a really important micronutrient that phytoplankton need. So if you've got anything that's even the krill themselves pooing, and that's where we've got to now, it's likely that it's the krill swarms themselves, these millions of little animals pooing themselves, very rich, iron-rich poo that will be fertilizing their local patch, and then the whale comes along, eats the krill, and it's doing massive poos that are also enhancing that very localized fertilization, and it all enhances that local productivity. Yeah. So at a time when there were, you know, 250,000 blue whales in the ocean before we started hunting them, there would have been a marked effect of having those large predators feeding and pooing and fertilizing the ocean in their local patch.
That's very interesting. Just, you know, being able to observe and collect all that data, and just having to be able to, because it's the two species that you're having to distinguish the data that you're getting from to be able to identify which one and what it's doing. It's very, very cool. Yeah, finishing on poo, this seems like a good way to go. So we will move on to some of those other soft questions. So what's a hobby or interest you have that is most unrelated to your field of work?
Well, as a working mum, I don't really have many hobbies, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I'd like to say I was better, but I'm usually so exhausted by the end of the day, I don't do an awful lot other than get the kids to bed and
crash
to bed. But I used to be a very keen kayaker, not competitively. So, you know, ultimately I will get back into that. I love walking and cycling. But I suppose now what keeps me sane is my garden. I'm a very keen gardener. So a couple of years ago, we moved to a property that it's only 2 acres, but it still needs a lot of work. And we've planted over 50 trees. We've created an orchard. We've planted I don't know how many.
Oh, wow.
In the efforts to sort of beat the wallabies and the possums. And they keep beating us, but I'm getting more successful at using plants that they don't eat. So I'm never happier than when I'm actually out in my garden, you know? So you don't actually leave home, you don't have to do anything specific, but you're still achieving something.
Oh, that's great. And, you know, it's nice to be able to have the actual literal acreage to be able to work with for that. It's wonderful.
Yeah, we're very lucky.
Yes, very, very lucky. Okay. So which childhood book holds the strongest memories for you?
There are many answers I could give for this. One of the obvious ones is... There are ones that you would have heard before and others that aren't. All the books that I remember as a child are the ones that my dad read to me. My dad was the sort of went to work, so did my mum as well, but basically he'd be the one who read us to bed. And I remember him always twisting stories, putting funny voices on. And I remember very vividly him reading The Hobbit to us and doing all the scary voices, Gollum, that scared the living daylights out of us. And this was pre-movie, so we had only imaginations. And it was very fond because mum and dad chose my name, Eleanor, from The Lord of the Rings. And the flowers.
Oh, that's a delight.
Yeah, the flowers that grows in the Valley of the Fairies that Sam Ganji calls his little daughter at the very end of the books, calls her Eleanor. But I also, thinking about this question, was hilarious was just those classic Ladybird books, the really old-fashioned covers that you had that we had when we were very little, and my dad reading them but doing silly things. Like I remember Cinderella, and one I remember it for the beautiful dresses that Cinderella wore and how beautifully they were illustrated, but two, because my dad would never just say when Prince Charming, when people want to come and dance with Cinderella, rather than Prince Charming saying, excuse me, this is my partner, he'd always say, push off, this is my partner. And so just all those cheeky things my dad used to do. And I remember the witch climbing down Rapunzel's tower on Nika.
A bit of colour.
Nika elastic.
So. Oh, that's great. But yeah, it's good to add a little bit of colour to it.
And I've had a lot of fun doing twisting books for my kids as well. Although it's not always the best strategy when you want them to go to sleep earlier if they're giggling away in bed.
No, it's not. Exactly. It winds them up a little bit, but at least they're having fun. Lovely. And lastly, what advice would you give someone who'd like to do what you do, and what advice should they ignore?
Oh, there's so many bits of advice. I think the key one that sits for me and has been a very strong theme throughout my career is that you, firstly, you don't necessarily have to have an idea of where you're going, because your career can take you anyway, and it's better to be interested in what you're doing and just have a give it a go. But I think the key theme is other people. So first of all, to collaborate. Gone are the days where you have ivory tower academics who just have their own little study project and they can get funding for that. Now you really do have to work with people all over the world in order to get results. And put all those pieces of the jigsaw together. So the work that we do would not be possible without people who could build the technology that we use, design the technology, drive the boats, do all the different aspects of research. Okay, we're quite capable of going getting biopsy samples from whales, but we're not geneticists. We can't analyze those samples, so we collaborate with geneticists. We collaborate with people who are brilliant at matching photographs of whales and are developing AI algorithms that will rapidly match whale photos. So it's just this massive collaborative network, and we wouldn't be able to do what we do without it. So I think you've just got to build your networks as you go.
Yes.
And then also finding an individual person, like a mentor who can help you through, be that someone who becomes, they don't have to be a good friend, but they could be a good friend who supports you through rough times and good times. Or an academic, if you're lucky enough to find someone in your career, or even outside of academia, in my case, that you just someone who can support you and you can talk decisions through with before you make them.
Yes, absolutely. Because, you know, you do need that outside perspective sometimes.
Absolutely, especially when it gets tough and you might say towards the end of your PhD when you're thinking about giving up and you've only really got to keep going for a few months. You need someone to get everybody goes like through this. You can do it. It's fine. Just keep going. Don't throw this away.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, even with my undergrad, towards the end of our, it's only 3 years, right? But even towards the end of that, we did have a couple of friends who just said, no, I can't take this anymore. You know, 6 months ago, but I can't do it. It's like, no, six months, and then you can just say you're done, and then you don't have to worry about it again.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you find mentors?
How do you find them? Sometimes you just stumble upon them. you might just end up with people who are just exceptionally good to talk to or exceptionally supportive of you. A lot of the time, I think you have to actively seek them. If you're lucky enough to be in an institution or in a business, I mean, I don't just talk to scientists here, but there often are schemes in place where you're matched with people. Take advantage of them. You're not locked into always working with the one person you're allocated or you choose. You can always change. But you might have to actively seek or just ask, because I don't know many people who would say no. Okay, they might be really busy people who couldn't meet with you every week, but I don't know many people who wouldn't say, yeah, sure, I'll be your mentor. We'll lock in once a month or once every 2 months that we meet and have a coffee or we have a Zoom. And we'll have a chat. And if it works for both of you, it continues to work. And if not, you change. And another way is you could, if you get the support of an institution or a business to get a coach, you can actually employ coaches. And I've had, you know, had a lot of success with that, where we've got specific tasks coming up. And I know there might be tricky personnel issues or tricky, whatever that needs dealing with. And you might want some very specific advice about something. Always take training opportunities when you've got them.
Yes, absolutely. It's wonderful. It's brilliant advice. Okay, so, well, thank you so much, Eleanor, for speaking with me today. It has been amazing listening to your wonderful journey. So, you know, varied and colourful, and so many opportunities that, you know, very few people would have that chance to take, and, you know, being brave enough to just say, yeah, I'll give it a go and see what happens. Yeah,
very either brave inspiring. Or unfocused so enough.
Well, you know, it's a bit of both sometimes. Like, you just, you know, it's always multiple things that drive you, right?
Absolutely.
Brilliant. So if people would like to find out more about the work that you do, how can they find out?
Well, one of the best places to go is the Australian Antarctic Division website, because there's sort of bios about myself and the team that I work with, and all sorts of links to the research we do.
Wonderful. Definitely. I'll include those in the show notes. Okay. And thank you so much again today. It's been absolutely wonderful. And yeah, I hope you have a brilliant day.
Thank you so much, Michelle. Great talking to you.
It's amazing to think that I can work on both the smallest organisms on the planet as well as the largest in a single career. But that's exactly what Eleanor has done, and she's been able to pull together all her previous experiences to be able to fulfill her passions in conservation and outreach. To learn more about Eleanor and what we discuss on the show, or to connect with us, please visit the Steam Powered website at steampoweredshow.com. You can also find out more about Eleanor's work and the Australian Antarctic Program through the Australian Antarctic Division, the links for which will be in the show notes. If you enjoyed this conversation and want to hear more like it, subscribe to this podcast and share this with your geeky or geek curious friends. You can also support Steam Powered on Patreon and Ko-fi under Steam Powered Show, the links for which will also be in the show notes. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.